From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The U.S. House of Representatives shot down a financial bailout bill, but today the U.S. Senate is set to vote on their version of the plan. Plus, Alaska Governor Sarah Palin goes head-to-head with Senator Joe Biden tomorrow night. It's the one and only vice presidential debate. What can we expect on both fronts? We've got Robert Trainum, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. How you doing?
Hello, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great. So we've got this big bailout that failed in the House. Is the Senate bill different? And if so, how?
Well, it's slightly different in the sense that the language is almost identical. But the difference is that there's a little bit more momentum on the Senate side to get something done for two reasons. Number one is to try to slow down this downward trajectory that it seems like Wall Street and the Dow is on. But also, secondly, to try to put some pressure on the House of Representatives to say, see, we have done this. We've taken a hit. You have to do the same.
What are the politics, and let's break this down by party, what are the politics of this bill for the Republican Party, where you generally saw more members voting against this bailout? Basically in the House of Representatives, everybody is up for reelection at this point. Republicans are expected to lose seats in both the House and the Senate. Are people genuinely thinking this is a bad idea, or are they afraid to go against their constituents, or both?
Well, two things. First and foremost, you have to remember that Republicans just intuitively do not believe, most House conservatives do not believe that this was the right approach. Because their attitude is more of a free market attitude. The government should not in any way, shape, or form interfere with the private enterprise. That's number one. Also, number two, a lot of House Republicans out there said, you know what, why in the world are we rewarding bad behavior? Why in the world are we going out there and we're, quote unquote, bailing out these CEOs and Wall Street executives when they in the first place should not have granted these, quote unquote, bad mortgages or bad debt? And thirdly, and last but certainly not least, a lot of Republicans felt as though is that the poison was in the well even before they voted. They point to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi making a very partisan speech right before the vote. And secondly, they also feel as though is that an organization called Acorn, which, as you know, Farai, is an organization that helps low-income families out there get homes, they believe that that's an extension of the Democratic Party, and thus in the process was a free giveaway in the tune of $30 to $40 million for that organization. So for them, first and foremost, it was a huge philosophical pill for them to swallow, and they just weren't willing to swallow that pill.
Donna, why do you think, and let me just say, we have with us Donna Brazile, Democratic strategist. Donna, thanks for coming on. And do you think that this really broke in terms of politics or policy? Do you think that some Democrats, and yesterday we had on Representative Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas, who voted against the bill, and as well Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California, who voted for it. So neither party had a complete unanimous vote. But do you think that this was more politics or policy in terms of how people made up their minds?
Farai, I believe this was a crisis of leadership on behalf of not just the executive branch, but also the legislative branch. You know, when Wall Street catches pneumonia, Main Street comes down with a severe cold. And when this proposal was put forward, it was put forward as a bailout for Wall Street, because Wall Street had illiquid assets on their books that was causing the credit market to dry up. Now, I think when the Democrats and the Republicans sat down together to come up with a negotiated settlement on how to unclog Wall Street's arteries, Main Street felt that they were bailing out Wall Street. After all, over the past 2 years, there's been $62 billion in bonuses given to Wall Street brokers, and Main Street felt they were being left out. So I think part of the problem is that this deal was brokered without consideration of taxpayers. And whether it's conservative Republicans or liberal Democrats who said no to the deal, the fact is this was a crisis of leadership. And to blame this crisis on a speech that if you saw Pelosi give her remarks, she was addressing her Democratic caucus. She was told that she had to deliver 120 votes. She delivered 140. She cannot deliver more than that because there are Democrats who believe that this proposal will not go far enough in relieving homeowners of the burden that they have now with these mega mortgages that they can't afford. And the foreclosure crisis is real, and we need to address that immediately.
Well, let me jump in here because I want to play a little bit of Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd, who really felt that got to pass this.
The last thing we need is to have this not work again. We better decide whether or not we're serious about this. This is a difficult vote. I wouldn't suggest otherwise, but an important one. And that I know that those who cast votes yesterday are having some second thoughts about the condition they placed us in and are trying to find a way in which to get back on track again.
All right, guys, I want to actually be able to move on and talk a little bit about the vice presidential debates. But before we do, what do we expect from the Senate on this? I mean, one thing I've noted is that international leaders are saying, get your act together, America, pull it together. We need you to pull it together. But what do you think the Senate is going to do? Robert first.
They're going to send a very strong message to Wall Street, but also to Main Street, that this is something that needs to be done immediately. And just to augment what Donna said a few moments ago about the lack of leadership, the Senate is going to try to show leadership and try to pass this in a strong bipartisan way. You know, Farai, very quickly, the failure here is that no one connected the dots and walked John and Sally Smith and Fargo, North Dakota, as to why that this is important to them. The only thing that the average American sees out there are these golden parachutes and, you know, Citigroup buying Wachovia and Lehman Brothers failing. They don't understand exactly how this affects them in terms of their daily credit, whether it be getting a home, a car, an extension of their home equity line, whatever the case may be. The president didn't do that. He tried to last Thursday night, but he failed to do it. Speaker Pelosi failed. Everyone failed to paint this picture for the ordinary American out there that's living paycheck to paycheck.
And Donna, let me add to that. There are some politicians brandishing a petition from academics saying the rescue isn't a good idea. These are academic economists. Some of them are saying that the government should buy up individual mortgages, and that's a solution that might go down easier with voters. So do you think that that's going to affect at least one senator is really saying this backs up the idea that you should not vote for a bailout? What do you expect from the Senate?
Well, first of all, I think the American people should understand that regardless of what passes in the Senate, we are still going to have a major economic crisis on our hand. Manufacturing is now down. The auto sector is down. I'm worried that once this bill passes, Main Street will go back to business as usual, and they don't understand the long-term implications of not dealing with the foreclosure crisis. Home prices are now at an all-time low, and the value of people's homes continue to drop. And as the value continue to drop, people are going to ask themselves, should I stay in this house when it's worthless? So we have another crisis that we have to deal with. And it's important that members of Congress learn how to multitask, communicate better with the public, and show more leadership and less partisanship. I get this as a homeowner, as a taxpayer, and as a small business owner. I get it. And if we can't explain it, as Robert said, to someone in Fargo or Peoria or New Orleans or whatever, we're going to have a hard time getting our economy back on track. And remember, we live in a global economy.
All right. I've got a couple things to ask you about this vice presidential debate coming up tomorrow night. One is, if each of you could ask someone from the opposite side of the aisle a question. So, Donna, if you got to ask Alaska Governor Sarah Palin a question, what would it be?
Well, you know, she is a governor. She's undefeated in debate, 7-0. She defeated a Republican governor and a former Democratic governor. So I would say, Governor Palin, as vice president, you will inherit a $10 trillion national deficit. What steps would you take to get our economy back on track to produce jobs and to get us back in the global economy? I would go straight to the economy.
Robert, what would you ask Senator Biden?
Senator, during the Democratic debate, when you were running for president last year, you said that Senator Obama was not, quote, fundamentally ready to be president. You said that this is not on the job training, given the crisis that we were in. And that was obviously in the context of the war. Now that we're in an economic crisis, as well as a foreign policy crisis, to use your words, as it relates to the war, do you still believe that the number one person on your ticket is ready to be president on day one?
Wow, good stuff. Well, one last thing. The moderator is Gwen Ifill of PBS, and she is set to release a book on Senator Obama and the what some people call the Obama effect in January of 2009. Now, some people are saying that she's pro-Obama and she shouldn't moderate the debate. Is that a fair charge, Robert? Quickly.
It's fair in the context of whether or not she's going to be fair or not. Look, we all have our opinions about this race. There's no question about it. As an African-American, Senator Obama has stirred emotions in a lot of people, both good and bad. As an African-American, I'm very proud of him. However, you do have to be objective in these debates, and I think that's the question for Gwen Ifill. I have confidence that she will be fair. And very, very quickly, if I'm the McCain campaign, this is a gift for me because, again, it lowers the bar even lower for Sarah Palin.
I'm offended. No one, you know, looked at Jim Lehrer because of his white skin and say, will he be fair and objective? Gwen Ifill is a nationally respected journalist, anchor on PBS, and she is writing a book that chronicles how black politics is changing in the aftermath of the Obama presidency. The book is not even out. She is one of the smartest people I know, and I know a lot of people in Washington, D.C., and attacking the press has become a central front in the strategy of winning votes. And it's unfortunate that Gwen is being put through this. And let me just say something. Farrah, you would be a great moderator. Not because you're black and you're a sister, of course, but because you understand the issues, you're objective, and you know how to, you know, pose these questions in a way that would get answers and not just spin. So if not Gwen, if they have to replace Gwen Farrah, I'm for you.
Oh, well, I appreciate
Absolutely.
I appreciate it. I you know, what's that whole phrase? You know, I will not put myself in contention, but if someone else does, how far be it from me to pass that over. And on that very flattering note, that's all we have time for. Thanks, guys.
And thank you for your wonderful journalistic skills.
Thank you. And I'm going to start a website, farrahnow.com.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank
that's
you.
Enough. All right. We were talking with Donna Brazil, Democratic strategist and author of Cooking with Grease, Stirring the Pots in American Politics, and Robert Trainum, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. They both joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Okay, we've got our bloggers coming up to slice and dice pop culture and politics. But before that, we have a man who knows how to swing his own cultural katana. That is Jeffrey Bennett, the web producer for News and Notes. How's it going?
I'm doing well, Farai. How are you?
Great. So change is the only constant, or some folks say that. Definitely true with our blog, with NPR right. Online. What's going on?
Well, NPR.org has introduced a host of social networking tools, which people are probably familiar with using from sites like Facebook and MySpace. So the biggest change now is that you have to register and create a profile in order to leave comments on our blog and our segment pages. And so once you've registered, it takes all of about 2 minutes. You can comment on our blog, on NPR stories, you can check out other people's profiles, and you can recommend stories to other readers. And even if you don't register with us, you can still recommend our stories, which, you know, we'd be grateful for.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
So how are folks online responding to this whole economic crisis / economic bailout?
Yeah, right. Well, a reader named Diane West wrote, "Mr. Bush has cried wolf too many times. Who can believe him?" And another reader named Ben Shepard wrote this, "It was unethical risk-taking individuals who abused the lack of regulation, and they should be the ones paying the price to get us out." And so we took an unscientific poll. We asked, did you support the $700 billion bank bailout planned? 63% of those polled said no. And we asked, who holds the blame for the bill's failure? 39% said Republicans. 39% said both parties.
Hmm. All right. Rapper David Banner stopped by earlier this week for an interview, and we're going to air that at a later date, but part of it's already up on our blog. How did that unfold?
Well, yeah, he's a new breed of conscious rapper, I guess you'd call him, and he posed a question to our audience, which we posted online right after that interview was done, and here it is.
I want to say something that I've never heard anybody say before, and I want you guys to think about this. America fights to make every other place in the world have a democratic process, right? Then why are we the only ones with an electoral college? So are we truly democratic when it comes down to it?
So why do we have the electoral college, he asks. And so we're taking people's responses on our blog.
All right. Well, I can't wait to see what folks have to say. And we have different ways that we blast out video. We've got a YouTube channel. It keeps getting more and more popular. Mm-hmm. What do we have up there now?
Well, all of our big-name celebrity interviews are there, including our most recent interview with Spike Lee. We had a peppery exchange between Spike Lee and NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates. And here's part of that.
A black man, someone whose father was born in Uganda, the motherland.
Kenya.
Excuse me. Sorry, Barack.
East Africa, yes, but
yes. Born in Kenya is going to be the commander in chief.
He certainly will be if he's elected.
He's going to win.
If he wins, does
I'm sorry. Whoa! You could say if.
Well, I have to. I'm a reporter.
Okay, but I'm not a reporter, and I can't let people ask me. So, what happens if he? I don't think like that. The man we're going to be delivered on November 4th.
Great stuff, right?
Absolutely. You can hear the tension right there.
Yeah, and there's a comment on that after that video that says, Spike is rarely a boring interview, which is to say the least. So,
all right.
So that can be seen on our YouTube channel.
Yeah, fabulous. Jeff, thanks.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me from the studios of NPR West. Did black folks cause the mortgage crisis and ruin the economy? And should Sarah Palin step aside for the good of the GOP? We've got these stories and more right now on our Bloggers Roundtable. Here to weigh in, Carmen Van Kerkhove. She blogs at Racialicious and heads the anti-racism training company New Demographic. Jim Collier, who writes the blog Acting White, and Shay Riley, who writes the blog Booker Rising. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi there.
So, you know, some folks are now saying that black people caused the mortgage collapse. Academic John Lott wrote a piece for Fox News Online saying, among other things, quote, the changes in underwriting standards were pushed to accomplish what many called a noble goal, an increase in home ownership among poor and minority Americans. But the changes created a time bomb that was set off as soon as property values began to decline. But journalist and blogger Ta-Nehisi Coates fired back with a commentary for The Atlantic that said there's a subset of conservatism that doesn't just oppose diversity and affirmative action, but will use virtually anything as a club to make their point. So that's going back and forth and back and forth. Jim, what do you think of this idea that black folks and other people of color were, you know, in essence, disproportionately responsible for the bad loans that they got and for the economy's troubles?
Well, Farai, I was frankly surprised at the comment. I mean, I guess I'm not so dismayed. I'm sort of used to these things. But I think it's really key that, you know, when people drive their neighborhoods, and no matter what neighborhood you drive, you see the signs out. And so if you live in a million-dollar neighborhood, you see million-dollar signs out. And if you're middle income, you see that. And even if you're low income, you see that as well. So, I mean, there's enough empirical evidence around to see that it actually does not fall on a single group. I think what people are really missing, though, is way back in 2000, at the end of the big stock boom, some money left Wall Street. It left the stocks, and it was pushed into the real estate market. And that money was trying to jump hurdle rates that it was used to for the roaring 90s. And they got loose and goosey in how they loaned it out. And now they're trying to put it on the backs of poor people, and when the reality is the friends of mine who are in trouble with over $2 million of real estate each, and those are not poor people.
Mm. And this is something that also is becoming a media issue. I mentioned the commentary from Fox News Online, but also on the air, Neil Cavuto, who hosts Fox News' Your World, also made a very sharp version of that statement, which a lot of people got angry about, a sharp version of the whole statement that giving home mortgages to minorities really was the cause of this crisis. Carmen, how do you think this is playing out as a media issue and a diversity issue?
Well, this is really a classic blame the victim strategy. So instead of blaming the people who actually have the power to make these decisions, you're blaming the victims of the fallout of this. And I think that, you know, one of the key issues to me is the lack of visibility of stories of people of color in the media. I mean, when we talk about who's affected by this economic crisis, we hear about Wall Street and Main Street. You know, we see the Lehman Brothers bankers leaving their offices with, you know, their stuff in cardboard boxes. We hear hear about sort of the white suburban homeowner who's being put in jeopardy. But rarely do you actually see the stories of people of color who are affected by this crisis. And I think that, you know, arguably, in any kind of tough economic time, it's often people of color who are disproportionately affected by that. And yet those stories are rendered completely invisible by the media.
Shay, do you think that this is a case where, you know, regardless of the manipulation sometimes of consumers, that if you crunch the numbers, well, yeah, disproportionately, blacks and Latinos did have mortgages that failed, and that we should just face up to that? How do you make sense of this?
Well, I need to actually see the figures to see if that is indeed the case. And I don't believe that there was manipulation, because there is also consumer responsibility to know what you're signing and to make sure you can afford the mortgage. But black people did not create this financial mess. It was big government which created this mess, whether it's tax breaks for homeowners, whether it's the de facto and now potentially actual government bailout guarantee, encouraging collateralization and sale of mortgages to investors, or even the Federal Reserve's monetary policy. Big government has its hands all over this mess, and in terms of inflating housing prices and creating incentives for companies to give loans out to people who couldn't afford the mortgages in the first place, because they know that if there's any risk, any downside, government, i.e. the taxpayers, will bail them out. And I don't think Democrats or Republicans should be for this, but yet both parties want to try to solve the problem with even more big government, which is ridiculous.
Well, Shay, let me stick with you on another topic. You've got some conservatives raining on Governor Sarah Palin's parade. George Will, David Brooks writing and criticizing her, and the conservative pundit Kathleen Parker saying that John McCain has to dump Palin from the ticket. She wrote a piece for the National Review, and she said that she was supporting Palin, but after seeing the interviews, she said, quote, "If BS were currency, Palin could bail out Wall Street herself." That is pretty harsh. What do you think, Shay? Is there any chance that the GOP itself will start mounting a revolt and saying that Sarah Palin needs to go?
I don't think so. I don't think that John McCain or the Republican National Committee will, you know, tell Sarah Palin to step down. I just think that's a politically untenable position for both of them to do. But, you know, there's long been this cultural divide between, I guess you would call them the conservative pundits like George Will, et cetera, you know, who focus more on fiscal and national security issues as the main thrust of their conservatism, versus people like Rush Limbaugh or Reverend James Dobson, who are cultural conservatives and who are more populist in nature and who view the pundits as elitist. So there's long been that tension within the conservative movement. And movement conservatives love Sarah Palin because they view her as non-elitist. She's kind of come up and had some struggles both in her past and with her her pregnant daughter. And they love her religious perspective, whereas the pundit conservatives, who are more from the Upper East Coast, you know, don't think she cuts the intellectual mustard and just don't like her on the fiscal and national security issues.
Well, Jim, you're blogging about some of the dump Palin issues. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I mean, I appreciate this sort of dissension in Republican partisan politics, because, you know, it's too easy for each of the groups to get into their sort of monolithic lockstep. And it's important to see that either group, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, can actually get to a point in their rhetoric where they actually believe that the country's health and welfare is at stake and not just them winning. And I think that this is what we're seeing with Republicans, and it's actually sort of refreshing. I hope that if the case was the same on the Democrat side, that that's what we'd see. But personally, it's why I'm an independent, and because I try to make my own impartiality as opposed to sort of, again, walking in lockstep.
Carmen, when you think about what's going on, I mean, let's put this in context. There's really only one person who has ever been on and off a ticket. We're talking about vice presidential candidate for the Democrats, Thomas Eagleton, in 1972. It was revealed he had gone through shock therapy for mental illness, for depression. That's a very specific case in a very specific time. Do you think that there's anything that, you know, aside from an actual crime that was proven at the last minute, that could get someone off a presidential ticket?
I think it's highly unlikely that we'll see Palin being asked to step down. You know, I wish I remembered where I read this, but either on someone's blog or Twitter feed, they said that, you know, we really need to stop calling this anti-intellectualism and start calling it dumb loving or stupid embracing. And, you know, I just really feel like Palin is just the epitome of this trend in the U.S. where, especially, you know, when it comes to politics, there's, you know, this focus on, well, I want to vote for the person who's just like me. I want to vote for the person who I would want to grab a beer with. This is not the time to vote for the person you want to have a beer with. You know, that's what happened. That's what got us 8 years of George Bush. This is really the time to vote for the smart person who's going to be able to get us out of this mess. And clearly, from the awful, you know, cringe-inducing interviews that Palin did with Katie Couric, she has no idea how to do that. So I just think it's, you know, as much as I would like to see it happen, I do think it's unlikely.
All right. What do you think about the debate tomorrow night then, Carmen? Do you think that it's going to be a train wreck, either one side or the other or both?
Well, as a lot of commentators have pointed out recently, at this point, the expectations are so low that it's very unlikely Palin could possibly, you know, perform worse than people are expecting. So probably it'll just seem okay. Yeah, I mean, she'll just come off as seeming, oh, not quite as inept as maybe we had hoped or expected.
All right, Shay, we touched on this earlier in the show with our political analyst, but PBS's Gwen Ifill is moderating the debate, and some conservative bloggers, including Michelle Malkin, are saying that she's pro-Obama. She's got a book that's going to come out on Inauguration Day, January 20th, 2009, called The Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama. Should that disqualify her from being a moderator?
Yes, it should, because she has a conflict of interest. Because, of course, if Obama should win the presidency, that helps her book. So it's in her interest to, you know, push the Obama ticket. And she has, you know, been a supporter of Obama. At the very least, if she's not removed from tomorrow's debate, she should note her conflict of interest up front. But, you know, on a larger note, I think we should just get rid of this pretense of moderation, because there's no such thing as objectivity when it comes to these debates. You know, whereas other people looked at the different debate moderators and noticed the lack of race and gender diversity, I noticed that too. But more importantly, what I noticed was the lack of ideological diversity. And what I would prefer is just to have a debate and let the two candidates go at it with very minimal moderation. So I don't even like the entire setup.
All right,
but
yes, let me give...
she is biased.
All right, Jim, okay. The final word. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that her reputation in history is one that where she deserves the benefit of the doubt. I think where she has really crossed the line and where she should step back, though, is this release of the product or the book on Inauguration Day. I think that that's a promo gimmick designed to benefit her pocket and the publisher's pocket, and that's what really pushes the conflict of interest, and she should back away from that.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Jim Collier, who writes the blog Acting White. He was at the studios of the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. Carmen Van Kerkhove, who blogs at Racialicious, she was at our New York studios. And Shay Riley, who blogs at Booker Rising, she was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation doesn't stop here. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. During the Great Depression, the federal government employed 6,000 writers and researchers. They fanned out across the nation to create a historical document of the country's diversity, the goal to describe America to Americans. Today, 50 writers did a modern-day interpretation of the original project. The book is called State by State, A Panoramic Portrait of America. We've got co-editor Matt Weiland and the writer who tackled the state of Michigan, Mohammed Nasihu Ali. Welcome to you both.
Hey, thank you.
So, Matt, I understand the book was inspired by the Federal Writers Project of the 1930s. So give me a little historic background. We're kind of in not such great financial shape right now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, oddly, things seem to be lining up similarly to the time when the Federal Writers Project was conceived and foisted upon the American public. It was a wonderful thing. 6,000 American writers, some of the greatest writers in American history, Nelson Algren and Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison and Saul Bellow and many, many more, Zora Neale Hurston, were part of the Federal Writers Project. They got their start writing for it, and the ideals behind it were, you know, not unlike now. It's a time of great anxiety and insecurity. And the fundamental point was to go out and describe America, to remind us all of what we had to be proud of.
What do you think it means to try to define a country? Does it show in some ways a sense of insecurity about what that country is?
Oftentimes, we allow the country to be defined by big commercial media, by reality television shows and driving on the interstate highways. Those are ways of describing the country that only yields a kind of an extraordinary sameness. You know, you can drive all over the country or just listen to commercial radio and get this feeling that the whole country is exactly the same wherever you go. Now, any of us who've gotten off the interstate or listened to public radio knows that the country is much more diverse than that. It's much more interesting than that. And so that was a fundamental point of the book, was to try to capture some of that particularity, some of the specificness of American life.
I completely agree with you, Matt, because this country is always changing with new immigrants coming from all over the place. And now with what is going on with Barack Obama being nominated, you know, as the head of his party, I think it's very necessary at this point to redefine, you know, America.
So, Mohammed, you got to tackle Michigan. And among other things, you talk about youpers and just how cold it is. But get us started. What brought you to Michigan in the first place?
Well, I was sent to Michigan at the age of 16. To study at Interlochen Arts Academy. It is a boarding school for the arts. And so when I was coming here, my expectation of America and Americans was, you know, was that of someone who always sees Americans and white people from a very long distance. So even though I was coming here to get an education, me going directly from Accra to Michigan was not only a huge shocker, but also instantly it puts me in the American society right in the Midwest. And the experience was fantastic. It was amazing. I learned so much from it, which has really defined what I am today.
You talk about a family that became like your second family. Tell me about them.
The Crockett family. This woman who used to work in the admissions office when I was a student. So at the end of the semester, she realized I didn't have any place to go. So she pretty much just invited me to come and join them and stay with them. And from there, she pretty much kind of adopted me, you know, to be part of the family in a very small town. And I think I was the first black person to live there. I'll probably be the last black person to ever live there. But then it was really great and very, very generous, very, very generous, and pretty much just took me like one of their own.
Matt, go ahead. I was going to ask you just to give me a quick sense of what other kinds of stories people have told about their states.
Of course. When we were deciding on who to write on what state, we decided very early on that we didn't want it to be a kind of beauty pageant of 50 writers, you know, from the state that they're writing about, you know, appearing in the book with sash and tiara and saying, you know, what's so wonderful about their own state, as appealing as it is to imagine some writers in sash and tiara. So some of the writers in the book write about their own state. S.E. Hinton, the great writer, author of The Outsiders, about Oklahoma, or Barry Hanna on Mississippi, or Edward P. Jones on D.C. We included D.C. in the book. But other writers wrote about the place that they moved to, like Jonathan Franzen on New York, and in others still, like Mohammed were pieces about coming to a place that they hadn't known before. And we thought that's such a typical American experience, especially the immigrant story, that it was really important to us to capture that. So this is a book where you'll read about Bosnians in Missouri or Bangladeshi immigrants in Rhode Island and Chinese in Georgia. Ha Jin, the wonderful novelist, writes about Georgia, or Mexicans in Iowa. We sent Dagoberto Gilb, the Mexican-American novelist, to Iowa to hang out in the cornfields with the workers there, because those are stories that give us some sense of American self-confidence and buoyancy, which I think is important to hear right now in a moment of enormous anxiety.
Well, Muhammad, you end up describing yourself as an Afrigander. What's that?
Well, Afrigander is from Michigander. If you know, a lot of people maybe tend to think people from Michigan call themselves Michiganese, but they actually call themselves Michiganders. So someone from Michigan is Michigander, and I'm from Africa in Michigan, so I call myself an Afrigander.
So you got a lot of love for Michigan.
A lot of love. I still call it my state. Whenever people, taxi drivers here, ask me where you're from, I always say Michigan with a straight face.
What have you learned, Matt, as you start? You guys have a pretty ambitious tour of this book with different authors speaking in different places. What do you hope to put out there and to learn from that?
Well, I hope we'll reawaken, just as the original WPA Writers Project did, a sense of patriotism, with a lowercase p. I think all too often we talk about patriotism as kind of defending the country from without, from attack, say. But it's equally important, I think, to defend it from within, in the sense of reminding ourselves of all that we have to be proud of local traditions, culture, even local jokes and mom-and-pop independent stores, these things that we have and that continue to that persist and will only endure, I think, if we remind ourselves that they're there and insist that they remain.
Gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks a lot for having us.
Thank you.
That was Matt Weiland, co-editor of the new anthology State by State, A Panoramic Portrait of America. He joined us from the Audio Ruckus Studios in Minneapolis. And Muhammad Nasihu Ali, who wrote the chapter on Michigan for the book. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York City. From the comedy stage to the big screen to television, Niecy Nash brings sass and style to everything she does.
I am here at the CMA Music Festival. It is where the biggest country stars come to perform and meet their fans. I'm going in.
This is my bus right here you're looking at.
It's 1955 right here.
1955? Does that mean I have to sit in the back?
I'm Niecy Nash, and I am backstage at the Kamora Lee Simmons Baby Fat Fashion Show. Oh, I'm going in. What is the one thing they don't have back here that they need? Ha! That's how I do it. Who want a donut? I'm Niecy Nash, and this is Clean House.
The actress and comedian shines when she's working without a script. She is starring in two TV shows at once, Reno 911 and the home makeover show Clean House. Nash recently sat down with NPR's Tony Cox to talk about her career and how she got into the biz.
Man, like so many other people who do this genre of entertainment, was birthed out of tragedy. When I was, I want to say 15 or 16, I saw my mother get shot.
Oh.
And then maybe the day before my 22nd or 23rd birthday, my brother was killed. And so my family had experienced so much tragedy. And by the time my brother was killed, my mother, who had survived her incident, she was like in a horrible depression. So she's like, I'm getting into bed and I'm never getting back up. And she meant it. So I'm coming to her house every day and I'm standing at the foot of the bed telling jokes and stories and trying to pop lock and cabbage patch and, trying to work it out. And eventually she went from laying down in the bed to sitting up in the bed. So, well, I've got my peanuts and my water. Go on and stand up there and do your rendition of things. So one day I go to her house and she's not in the bed. I'm like, where's my mother? And I look, and she's like, we're in here. I'm like, who is we? Well, I went across the street, and I got the neighbors, and I told them you was funny. Stand up there. Y'all are going to love this. I'm like, what? So I'd start performing in the living room. That was how it started. And then I didn't want to be selfish. I realized in that moment that comedy was a gift. And so when I went outside and I said, I'm Niecy Nash and I'm funny, they were like, you're right. Get over here. We will give you a job.
Really? Now, you know, it's one thing to perform for your mama and the neighbors.
Yeah.
It's another thing to perform for the people that are going to put money in your purse.
Well, and I got to do that. I got to do that if I want to eat.
So how hard was it when you really stepped on to the professional stage?
It was a journey. It took some time, but I always believed that impression that had been pressed onto the canvas of my imagination. Like, this is what you are called to do. Pow, it was stamped right there. And so since I always believed it, when I walked that thing out, I never felt like there was another option.
Mm-hmm.
I used to be the only one taking three babies to an audition, but you know what? No matter what. I live by the no matter what of it all. So I would take my three babies, pack them up, and I would do what I got to do.
Now, you started out doing stand-up, but then you have moved away from stand-up into situation comedy.
Yes.
You like this better?
I like work.
Well, I understand that.
Yeah. Actually, I booked Reno 911 and Clean House, which is my home makeover show that I host, the same week. That following week, I booked Recurring on Bernie Mac. So it kind of all happened at the same time.
You got two TV show series and a recurring role on another series in the same week?
Uh-huh. Within about 2 weeks.
How'd you do that?
The man upstairs was feeling sorry for me. He was like, let me let this baby catch a break.
I heard that one of the auditions that you went into, you took your children and they were taking too long.
Oh, that was for Reno 911.
Tell us that story.
I went to the audition for Reno. The funny thing about that is that when I got that phone call, originally it wasn't improv that we were going to do. It was sketch. And they called and said, you know, can you do characters? I was like, yes. I had never done them. I was like, but let me, what is a paycheck is attached on the end of it? I'm going to figure it out in the car on the way there. So I lied and said I knew how to do it. But when I got there, they were running late. And I said, wait a minute. And so I went and knocked on the door, and it was maybe 15 people in the room. And I was like, are y'all about to get this dog and pony show started? And they were like, well, are you in a hurry? And I'm like, yeah, I got to get my kids to Chuck E. Cheese by 7 o'clock. And so I think they ended up hiring me. I don't even think I was the best girl, to be honest. But I do think that I was the most comfortable in my skin. And somehow that resonated. And they were like, get over here. We want to work with you.
You know, I want to talk about being comfortable in your skin, okay? Because I saw you in a blue swimsuit that was really thongish.
I was waiting on the T word. thong. I was waiting on you to hit me with that.
You were rocking that thong, and you weren't even at the beach.
Let's talk about that.
Let's talk, okay.
Okay. When they decided to switch from doing a sketch show to a unscripted parody of Cops for Reno 911, we all got to create our cop characters. They came to me and said, what kind of cop do you want to be? My daughter's best friend at the time was Rainisha Williams. And I was like, can I be Rainisha Williams? And they were like, well, yeah, okay, so what about her? And I was like, and I flashed back to every woman I ever loved when I was a little girl that influenced me and raised me. And I was like, can I have baby hair and a big booty? And they were like, yes. And so I went to a million booty fittings before we got the booty right. Cut two, you actually got to see the booty out of the pants. So we have to build it. So they put plaster all over my real booty, my hips, my thighs. So when you see the Rainisha booty, it's a prosthetic booty, but the foundation is mine.
Underneath is you.
Yes.
You are too crazy. Let's talk about somebody that you worked with who was really respected in the business, Bernie Mac.
Yes.
I had the opportunity to meet him myself once, a great guy. And you had an arc on his show, the Bernie Mac Show, and I've already told you that one of those episodes when you blew in with the Santa Ana wind story, I thought that was one of the funniest episodes they had. What was your relationship with Bernie?
when I came to the audition, there was a million women there who had series and, you know, auditioning to play his sister. It got down to the callback. And when I went back to the callback, it was only me and one other woman. And I go in and I have the little sides. And right before I walked in the door, the lady said, "Honey, we don't need the sides. You're going to just improv a scene with Bernie." And I said, "I'm sorry, what did you say?"
Can you repeat that?
And so I walked in, and he was there. "How you doing?" I said, "How you doing?" And I just took my shoes off and sat down, and we started talking. And he said, "The script is not the Bible. I got mine. I want you to get yours. Do you, and I'll follow." And I said, "What?" And I called my mother and I said, "Mama, Bernie Mac said he gonna follow me. Wait a minute." You know, and he was just generous. Yes, everybody knows him as a king of comedy, but the man who he was, just, he was a king. He himself, Bernie Mac, not just a king of comedy, but just a king to me anyway.
That was a great opportunity for you, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
You know, I look at you and I see your, this is your signature look, isn't it?
With the flower in your hair,
yeah.
Yes.
It's cute.
Thank you.
Is that what the brothers tell you? They say you're cute?
I don't even think they see the flower for everything else.
They can't get to the flower.
I don't even think they know this. The outer wrappings are going to do what they're going to do. You know what I mean? And it's always going to be somebody who like it.
Well, you're right about that. You know what you should do, Niecy Nash?
What should I do?
You should write a book, and it should be called Happy in My Skin.
Happy in My Skin. You heard it here first.
If you do it, when they say, "I want to thank somebody," just say, "I want to thank Tony Cox at News and Notes for giving me the title of my book."
How about that?
Okay. You don't have to give me any money. I don't want any money, but we can talk about that later. Thank you, Niecy.
Thank you for having me at News and Notes.
That was actress and comedian Niecy Nash speaking with NPR's Tony Cox. You can watch a video of this interview, you know you want to, at our website, nprnewsandviews.org. And that's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org.